From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nobody knows the White House like Helen Thomas. She's covered 9 presidents and has something to say about each one of them. In this hour, wit and wisdom from an American original, the one and only Helen Thomas. We begin tonight with the latest from Afghanistan. The start of the country's much-anticipated Loya Jirga has been postponed today. Delegates from around Afghanistan have gathered in Kabul and will begin meetings tomorrow to choose a new government. I spoke earlier with former NPR correspondent Sarah Chase. She's in Kandahar, Afghanistan, working for a public policy nonprofit and about to head north to Kabul. I asked her about the level of confidence among delegates and the Afghan people in the outcome of the Loya Jirga.
It's the most peculiar mixture of absolute faith and almost a talismanic sense that this event is going to solve all the problems. Everyone that I've spoken to is enthusiastic about the process, enthusiastic about having had the chance to select delegates, enthusiastic about what they believe should be the qualities of a competent delegate.
The news today, of course, was that the Loya Jirga was delayed for a day. The official reasons were, one was that 500 too many people had shown up for the Loya Jirga, 2,000 instead of 1,500. Another, Reuters, quotes a fine arts professor at Kabul University saying there weren't enough carpets to sit on. But on the other side, there is word that people are trying to cut deals offstage, backstage, and the deals simply haven't been cut yet. Will the whole thing be settled before the Loya Jirga even gets off the ground?
You know, to a certain extent, they will be. And yet that does not mean that it's not a democratic process. This isn't democracy as we in the United States understand it, where it's one person, one vote in private, a kind of personal enfranchisement. What you're about to witness and have been witnessing up till now is a kind of collective consensus building operation, where consensuses are arrived at on a group level, be it village, be it tribal unit, be it district or province, and move upwards from there. For example, and this was not actually an election for delegates, but it was after a province had elected its delegates. It then gathered tribal and community leaders in a shura, which is a kind of large council meeting, to pass a proclamation requesting that interim premier Hamid Karzai officially declare his candidacy and that the king, the former king, endorse him. Now, this had been carefully prepared in advance. By the time the leaders arrived in the provincial capital, there was no doubt that they were going to approve that proclamation. You know, the floor was open, there were speeches, the language was changed to some extent. But in that case, the outcome was already known in advance. Yet it's a democratic process, and so it's hard for us sometimes to get our heads around.
Understood. The issue of the king and the interim president, Hamid Karzai, has been in the air again today. The king has put out a statement saying that he will not stand for the presidency and that he supports the candidacy of Hamid Karzai. Is the expectation around Kandahar that it will be Karzai? Are people presuming that that will be the leader who comes out of this?
They are presuming that that will be the leader that comes out of this. The support for Karzai here in Kandahar is absolutely overwhelming. There's a lot of support for the king, too, but, you know, he goes here by the nickname Zahir Baba, which means basically like Papa Zahir. I mean, you know, there's a huge amount of sort of love and affection for him, but most people do see him as too old to actually govern this country effectively. And even, again, when pushed, although they see the time of his reign as one of extraordinary peace and tranquility compared to what came afterwards, they do admit that he didn't do much for the economic development of the country, and they don't really see him as someone who can substantively move this country in a forward direction. On the other hand, they see a value as a unifier. But I have to say that the kind of wishing and washing by the former king, Zahir Shah, has added quite a bit of static to this whole process. You know, many people familiar with the Loya Jirga institution said to me that it's important, actually, for delegates to arrive at the gathering more or less knowing what they wanted to do, what the options are, and where they wanted to go with it. And Zahir Shah has, until this latest proclamation, kind of played, you know, hard to get in a way, claiming that he didn't want any position, but in fact making it very clear in private that he did. And that has added a degree of confusion to the situation that some people say can actually allow for warlords and other people to approach ambivalent delegates. It allows for much more distortion of the process than if he had been clear from the beginning.
Are Afghans assuming that the fundamental tension in this Loyajirga will be between the Northern Alliance delegates and Pashtun delegates?
People don't phrase it as ethnically as Westerners tend to phrase it. The way they tend to phrase it, particularly in the South, is either they call them the commanders or the previous governors, the people who were in government previously. And by that, they tend to mean the leaders of the seven Mujahideen factions which fought against the Soviet invasion but also fought against each other and are largely responsible for leveling Kabul and much of the rest of this country. And throughout the country, really, there is very, very little sympathy or support for these people. And certainly in the South, the feeling is that they need to be moved out of government, that if they were given positions in the Bonn Agreement, which launched this whole process, that was a kind of starting point from which they could gradually be moved out of power, moved off of the political stage in Afghanistan. There is obviously a sense that there needs to be a balance in the new government, not necessarily an exact proportion according to a census which doesn't exist, but a reasonable balance among the different ethnic groups in this country, which is not the case right now. You know, this is a democratic body that has no rules. There are no set procedures for a Loyajirga. Somebody said to me that it's in the essence of Loyajirga that each Loyajirga is different, because each one is convened at a moment of acute national crisis. And so it's the nature of the crisis itself that shapes the Loyajirga and shapes its proceedings. And so there is a kind of wild card aspect to it that, you know, it's clear that the major issue that everyone wants to see resolved is who's going to run the country. But you never know what else might be raised, and there certainly will be some major institutional issues that may arise. And then the atmosphere of the proceeding will be very important in determining what its legitimacy might be. So, you know, this is, imagine a Congress without roll call votes, without, you know, whips, without rules of procedure. And just imagine the pandemonium that could ensue.
We can only imagine. Sarah Chase, it's always great to hear from you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for reaching me.
Sarah Chase has reported for National Public Radio from France, the Balkans, and Afghanistan, and is now working for a public policy nonprofit organization in Kandahar. A presidential press conference just isn't finished until Helen Thomas says, "Thank you, Mr. President." As longtime White House bureau chief for UPI and now as columnist for Hearst, she has covered an unprecedented 9 presidents. To put that in a little perspective, just think about the stories that she's covered, that presidents have walked through while Helen Thomas has sat in the front row. The Cuban Missile Crisis, Vietnam, Watergate, Monica Lewinsky, 9/11, all have unfolded on her watch. From her front row seat, Helen Thomas has seen a thing or two about the way presidents deal with tough spots and tough times. And in her new book, Thanks for the Memories, Mr. President, she says one key is humor. It's the saving grace of a savvy White House. It's the missing ingredient in every dictatorship. We're here tonight with Helen Thomas to look at laughter and the American presidency. It's your chance to turn the tables on the dean of the White House press corps. Who made you laugh in the Oval Office? Who kept the world sane with a good joke? And do you agree that humor is essential to democracy? Helen Thomas is in the hot seat tonight. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Washington is Helen Thomas. Good evening and welcome.
Thank you.
And from Vermont Public Radio is our very own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Ms. Thomas.
Hi.
Helen Thomas, we're going to eventually talk seriously about you tonight with the Bush administration, but before we get to all that, there's so much good humor in your new book. Is this a funny administration? How does it rank on Helen Thomas's humor scale?
Very low.
We're sorry to hear that.
It's not so funny, I don't think. I mean, the president gives nicknames, and he joshes a lot, quite a cut-up, but you know, I don't call that real wit or humor.
Well, we know it hasn't been a particularly funny time since 9/11.
Well, that's definitely, you know, it's very serious, and that's part of the problem, no question.
But George W. Bush does have a reputation, as you say, as a cut-up, as being high-humored. How does he compare, or his humor compare with the other presidents you've covered?
Well, it's not very high. I'm afraid I have not seen him that much in action. Maybe I've missed the boat somewhere, but I don't see the great wit or one-liners even. I mean, he's friendly, a hail fellow, well met, mm-hmm. and so forth, a backslapper and very Western style, but he doesn't really have what Kennedy and Reagan had in terms of the quick riposte.
We want to get into some of those great anecdotes that you convey, but I guess the basic question is, after all the years you've spent covering presidents in the different White Houses and administrations, what does an administration's style of humor or volume of humor tell us in some essential way about the administration?
Ability to laugh at yourself and to know that, for one thing, most presidents, at least now in the when their speeches are prepared by their good gag writers, mm-hmm. understand what self-deprecating humor will do. It makes everyone think, oh, they're so big, they'll laugh at themselves. And that does help a lot. So they've all sort of leaned in that direction. But I think true humor comes right from your own mind and heart.
So it goes to the human character.
And yes, it you have to know something to have true humor, I think.
You won't put George W. at the top of the list. Does he rank in the middle? Does he rank at the bottom?
I haven't seen any great humor. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm, as I say, I don't mean to slam him, but because some people have it and some people don't.
But we think
maybe you can think of something.
Well, I don't know. I'm just thinking of other presidents. They certainly weren't all great jokesters. I mean, Richard Nixon was not known as a great humorist.
Oh, and I didn't say so in the book either.
No, you didn't.
I've actually got an example of the Bush wit.
Please, Jack.
It was deliberate, but you still give him credit for that. This was at a Al Smith dinner in New York, and William F. Buckley was there, and he said, when Bill Buckley was at Yale, he wrote a book. And he paused, and he said, when I was at Yale, I read a book.
Right.
And maybe just one, the president who's proud of his gentleman C's.
Exactly.
Ellen Thomas, you put JFK, I guess, very high on the scale. Who else did you find as high-humored in the White House?
Well, Reagan he really had a storehouse of one-liners left over from his Hollywood days. And I think that Johnson, I mean, they were not one-liners, but he really had wit and humor. He understood, I mean, they were stem winders and so forth and very earthy, but you did laugh at the end of the story.
But an older style of Texas humor than George W. may bring.
That's right.
Stem winder is a kind of humor that you've got to have the patience, maybe even of an earlier generation, to work
if
that.
If it's the president of the United States, you'll stand and listen, believe me.
Yes, but then how many presidents have the patience to wind that stem, I guess?
Well, once in a while, reporters were people to him, and he always had to have people around. So we got in on quite a bit.
Ellen Thomas, do presidents like you and your persona in that press conference room?
No, they don't. I'm sure.
Not even now, when you've become a kind of American great aunt who calls the press conference to an end.
Well, I don't do that anymore because I'm with Hearst Newspapers and I write columns, and I'm no longer with the wire service after 50 some years, and that's the prerogative, the privilege of a wire service. Senior wire service reporter to close a news conference, so I don't do that anymore.
So that has passed on, but still, you know what a kind of figure you've become.
Enfant terrible.
Well, yeah, maybe enfant no more, but they're still not drawn to this discreet charms of Ellen Thomas there?
Well, that doesn't matter. I don't expect to be loved. Don't even, respected is much better in the end, and I wouldn't blame them if they didn't like me mm-hmm. or any reporter who was trying to ask very tough questions.
And they should be. You fought hard for that respect. We're going to come back and talk about the humor you found there and the road of a female White House correspondent over the many administrations that Helen Thomas has covered. Listeners, what's your favorite presidential humor moment? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Join us and Helen Thomas. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
You are.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with longtime dean of the White House Press Corps, Helen Thomas, and her new book, Thanks for the Memories, Mr. President, A Chronicle of Presidential Humor. What's your favorite presidential humor moment? And it's Helen in the hot seat this time. What's your question for Helen Thomas? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Helen Thomas, what were the hallmarks of the presidents who were the best humored? Did they tend to share it with the press corps? And I guess, how is it heard? How is it received? Is the press corps open to presidential humor?
Well, you know, they all appear at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and they have to be funny. So they always have good gag writers, and I think all their staffs pitch in. And they all come across very good, and they practice, and the timing is good, and so forth. But I must say, we all laugh, and so forth. But I'm talking about the wit that just comes from the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And some are quick on the draw, and some either ignore you or else they don't... They don't rise to the occasion in the same way.
Who were the best? Which ones rippled with humor? Give us some examples.
Well, rippled is...
Maybe too much, huh?
I think that Kennedy was the best in terms of, you know, the flashback. Immediately, he understood exactly the moment. And maybe it was his youth and being with it at the time, of his own time. So he always had a quick comeback.
Do you remember a particular moments that struck your funny bone or strike it even today?
Well, let's see. I was in a pool. Usually there are three or four reporters in a pool and crowds of photographers.
Mm-hmm.
Photographers are always welcome at the White House. Reporters are never.
Now, a pool for listeners is when access is limited and just a few reporters, often wire service reporters, are invited in to cover a particular event.
Exactly, and then to relay the information to all the other mm-hmm. members of the press. Well, we were called into the Oval Office, and I was the only reporter there. For some reason, the other wires hadn't heard the call, but I was the lone reporter with all the photographers, and Kennedy took one look at me and immediately said, "Miss Thomas of the Universal Press."
Meaning you represented them all.
That's right. And, you know, I was working for UPI then. But, mm-hmm. I mean, I thought, well, this guy. And once we women reporters were fighting for access to the National Press Club, and we were particularly protesting the appearance of a Latin American president at the press club where we couldn't cover it.
This is when women still had to sit in the balcony
That's
of the National
right.
Press Club and didn't get fed.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
So Kennedy was escorting this Latino leader to the door, and he pointed to me and he said, "That's one of the revolutionaries, the protesters." And so then I turned to the guest and I said, "Well, we forgive you officially." And Kennedy said, "But not personal."
There can be no forgiving.
Right.
Jack Beatty, as Helen Thomas writes about this, describes it, I'm reminded how comforting it is in a way to feel a sense of being in the moment when a president is well-humored, is responding to every second like that. It's comforting to think of a president that's just that tuned in.
Yeah, and when you get someone like LBJ, then you get the whole personality, the whole region in his anecdotes. And in Bob Dalek's recent biography of Johnson, Flawed Giant, and by the way, Helen Thomas's reporting is all through the book, he's got some wonderful LBJ one-liners. When LBJ was with the Chancellor of Germany, Ludwig Erhard, Mr. Erhard asked him, Mr. Johnson, were you born in a log cabin? And Johnson said, no, no, you're thinking of Mr. Lincoln. I was born in a manger.
And then
at another time, people were telling Johnson that Kennedy was quite a ladies' man, and he said,
oh, I think Jack got the big bleep out there. It was fitting for LBJ.
Oh, I'm laughing.
But Helen Thomas, that's not the only time. I think you write about another time that LBJ describes himself as God or close to God. Wasn't it when Kennedy, what was it, Kennedy and another candidate were vying? They were talking about who had chosen whom. Oh, help me here.
Yeah. I'm trying to recall that.
This is LBJ. So, the Lord must have been looking out for you, one of them said, and LBJ coming in and said, well, no, I'm not sure that I was there.
Yeah, something to that effect anyway.
Going for the really great power, Jack refers there to how LBJ represented a very genuine kind of Texas regional cultural humor.
Oh, I think so, definitely. He had it, and he saw the humor even in himself, although he wouldn't admit it.
And that came through in his humor.
The Texas twang and so forth.
Were there other
barnyard humor, I might add.
Well, and that aplenty. Did you see other presidents who leaned as heavily on their regional origin for the humor they brought to the White House?
Well, sometimes Kennedy would exaggerate the Bostonian accent at times, you know, when he knew it would bring a laugh. But not as much as Johnson.
And did Kennedy have the self-deprecating humor that you describe as so effective? He had a lot to be cocky about, I guess, young and powerful and a lot of adulation. Was the self-deprecation there?
Well, maybe not as much, but he knew how to make fun of his family and the wealth and so forth. My father told me not to buy a landslide, that sort of thing, when they were handing out money in West Virginia in particular and so forth. So, no, he didn't know how to make fun of himself.
Of course, there are different kinds of humor. You describe him as being so much in the moment. Were Ronald Reagan's anecdotes as keyed into what was going on, or was he, you know, dishing out canned humor?
No, I mean, they fit. Maybe they were not au courant, but they really fit. When he was shot, honey, I forgot to duck. We looked up as he was about to go into surgery, and he asked if all the doctors were Republican, that sort of thing. I mean, these things really sell well.
Do you remember times when the press corps really and truly sort of dissolved in tears of laughter? Does it ever get to that point, or is there always too much tension in the air for that?
No, sometimes there are some truly hilarious moments. I must say that you don't double up too often, but once in a while, and sometimes you almost don't dare laugh because it's a humiliating moment.
That makes the president suddenly look human and therefore humorous.
The butt of your humor.
How does Bill Clinton fit into your schema of humorous presidents?
Well, I think he had a good sense of humor. I mean, not as much as Reagan and Kennedy, but it was there. And he also had some good gag writers.
That made him look pretty good. We're talking with Helen Thomas about presidential humor. What's your favorite presidential humor moment? And when was the last time a president really made you laugh? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Helen Thomas, we're joined now by Joe Lockhart, who, of course, was right up there where Ari Fleischer is now during the Clinton administration. Joe Lockhart, good evening and welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. You were White House press secretary during President Clinton's impeachment trial. I guess you had the post.
It was quite a humorous time.
Yeah, very, just a rocking and rolling with humor. Before we get to just how humorous, just totally convulsed. Joe Lockhart, what's it like to be up there at the podium and have Helen Thomas firing questions at you?
It's a very unique experience. It's first off, you know, Helen's a first-rate journalist who always has tough questions. But probably the hardest part is, you know, this is all televised on C-SPAN. And most of the reporters, you look at them, and they're not very likable people. So it's easy to be mean to them. But it's hard to be mean to Helen because everybody looks at her and they know the great story about her and how she has spent, you know, the last many decades there. And, you know, I think it gives Helen a unique advantage.
Do you remember a particular moment where she had you on the hot seat and you wished she wasn't Helen Thomas?
Vice versa.
Yeah, probably the first, the last, and every day in between.
No, he always had me over, had me. I must say, I think he got the best of me.
Do you remember Joe Lockhart in the midst of President Clinton's really difficult trials, counseling him on humor? Is there a White House sort of jester crew who's brought in to say we can leaven this with a joke? Or when it got really bad around the deep part of the impeachment trials, was it just beyond that?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think one of the things that Washington offers up is sort of institutional moments where the president is supposed to be funny. We have these dinners where the press corps brings him in, and we work very hard on making him funny. And we went back and forth sometimes on how close to the edge we could cut it. And I think sometimes we got it right. I think sometimes we went a little over the line, but it was all in good fun.
Helen Thomas, what about President Clinton? Do you remember instances that maybe weren't scripted, but where he responded to something going on? And
well, I think everyone remembers the video, Farewell to Arms, when he was leaving the White House, and where he runs out with a brown bag, giving it to his wife, who is running for the Senate and so forth. I think those were moments, and they asked me to pretend I was sleeping in the press room, and he comes in, and I say to him, "Are you still here?" And I think everyone saw that video, or almost everyone, and it was funny, and he really went through the wonderful motions of it. But I want to say something about Joe Lockhart.
Yes.
I thought he was a great press secretary. He called a spade a spade. He knew the shortest distance between two points was a straight line. And you always felt that he was telling you the truth.
Joe Lockhart, that's pretty high praise.
Yeah, I just wish Helen was that nice to me when I was behind the podium. I mean,
well,
it's great to hear that, but I could have used it more a couple years ago.
I couldn't say it then.
I know, but I
would have been considered apple polishing.
Yeah. And how about President Clinton, Helen Thomas? He could dish it out. Could he take it?
Oh, yeah. I think so, very much so. You mean the president?
Yeah.
Listen, I the only time I ever saw him hesitate for 1 second and take a deep breath was on a very embarrassing Monica Lewinsky story, a question, I mean. Otherwise, every question put to him, he knew the answer, he gave it a thoughtful answer, and so forth. I just think that he was remarkable and brilliant.
He was famously brilliant. He was also called President Elvis sometimes for his kind of never-ending seduction of whoever was around him. Did he try and soft soap you, Helen Thomas?
No. He knew that would be impossible.
Let's let some of our callers in. Chuck is on the line. Welcome, Chuck. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Helen Thomas has made the point that President Bush has been disappointing when it comes to dishing out the humor, and I wonder how he would be at taking it. And I'm particularly thinking of the fact that despite being an alum of Andover and Yale and Harvard, he still can't pronounce the three-syllable word nuclear. Is that a fair topic for some public kidding? And if so, why hasn't anybody done it?
It would be probably for the late-night comedians. But I think we don't like to mock people. At the same time, I think much was made of his trouble with the English language during the campaign.
Mm-hmm. And is being funny by accident the same as being humorous, but
no.
Deliberately, Helen Thomas?
No,
I guess not.
It's not. You know, it isn't serendipity. You really have to have a brain to have humor, I think.
Joe Lockhart, do you think the country looks to laugh at the president or to look would prefer to laugh with a good-humored president?
Oh, I think the country likes to do both. I think the election of President Bush, for those who are Republicans and agree with him, has been very good. Democrats disagree, but it's been worse on the hardest hit are the late night comics. There's just not much you can do that doesn't seem, that doesn't seem totally mocking of him. I think, when you're trying to make fun of a president, you want to do it in a way that obviously is funny, but, is not done in a way where you're not tearing him apart.
You want to be a little sly.
Yeah, and I think Clinton was probably the best for them because, in addition to all the great things that he did, in my opinion, he certainly offered up lots of fodder. And I think they had a field day with him. And even Clinton had fun with it. I mean, he'd see some of it. Some of it, would cut a little too close, but a lot of it he laughed at. And, I think this president is particularly humorless. But then again, the president's not there to entertain us. He's there to run the country. And, this is a little sidelight that some of us watch. And it's not why he was elected.
It's not why he's there. That's right. Joe Lockhart, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Joe Lockhart was White House press secretary during President Clinton's impeachment trial. You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Michael's on the line. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi.
I
had a question about Donald Rumsfeld and how different he was to deal with than other secretaries of defense or just anyone, related with the White House.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know how closely you worked with Donald Rumsfeld or have covered him, if much at all, Helen Thomas. But what about the men and women around George W. Bush, Rumsfeld and others? Do you find a good humorist in the lot?
No, but I'll tell you this. I don't cover the Pentagon, but I have watched the briefings, and I think those reporters are rolling over and playing dead. He swaggers, Rumsfeld swaggers, he struts. Are you asking a question like that? He, intimidates them. I would say, yes, I am, and you are a public servant. You should be answering the question, especially when troops are not in jeopardy.
Maybe they need you over there. The Helen Thomas needle may be brought in.
No, I mean, the man's getting away with murder. Mm. He doesn't say anything, but he starts taunting everyone as though, he's there in the hot seat and he ought to be answering the questions. We have a right to know something. Do you know there's a war going on in Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't even read anything about it because there's nothing told to us. Mm. We don't know how many people we've killed. We don't know how many of us have died, our own people in this war. What's going on?
Jack Beatty, we're talking humor, and yet the reality of a war on terror, a war in Afghanistan, clicks in. And Helen Thomas says, guys and gals at the Pentagon, get more sharp in your questioning.
Well, yeah, I've watched some of those performances, too. And he is he's intimidated in that he's got this sort of haughty, he kind of
mocking.
He furls his eyebrows and looks at people quizzically as if to say, "Can you mean to tell me a grown-up person can ask a question as stupid as that one?" So it must be very hard.
I would say you're damn right. Answer the question.
But this business of answering questions, Ari Fleischer is a specialist at not answering questions, isn't he?
Tell me about it.
I mean, I've got some examples. This is from the New Republic. A reporter asked why one Arab League resolution mattered, but the other didn't. He said, "I'm not going to speculate about plans that the president has said that he has made no decisions on and have not crossed his desk."
You decipher that. We've got to take a short break. We'll come back and look at Ari Fleischer. We're talking with Helen Thomas about humor in the White House. We're at 1-800-423-8255. When was the last time a president made you laugh? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Helen Thomas, longtime dean of the White House Press Corps, longtime bureau chief there for the United Press International, now with Hearst as a columnist. She has a new book out called Thanks for the Memories, Mr. President, Looking at Presidential Humor Across 9 presidencies. What do you think? What's your favorite presidential humor moment? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Helen Thomas, to take us into a couple of other presidencies that we haven't touched on here. You mentioned earlier that Nixon's was not a president of hijinks and high humor. Were there moments?
No, he wasn't. I think that if he was making a crack, it was too bitter to come across as humor.
Mm-hmm. It just wasn't in there.
Right.
And you point out in the book, you quote the line that humor is necessary to democracy. This was Edward Bennett Williams' line. Humor is indispensable to democracy. It is the ingredient lacking in all dictatorships in what seems to be an increasingly authoritarian world. Maybe there's a Nixon lesson in there.
Well, I think that it wasn't that he was so authoritarian. It's just that right and wrong he got mixed up on sometimes. I always thought he had two roads to go, and he always took the wrong road.
Mm-hmm. Jimmy Carter?
Carter did not have a tremendous sense of humor. His mother and his brother did, and that's where we relied on them for real humor about Plains, Georgia, and so forth. Mm-hmm. His mother was fantastic. Mm.
And George Bush, the senior?
Not great humor, but good-natured.
Helen Thomas, when you look at the recent changes in the White House lineup and Karen Hughes being moved off the scene, there's speculation out there. I think, Jack Beattie, you were mentioning earlier today that Andy Card is talking about a real change in the profile of the Bush administration. Give us that question, Jack.
Well, he's quoted extensively in Esquire saying the whole balance of the place, the balance of what has worked up to now for George Bush is gone, simply gone. And then he goes on to say that there was a kind of balance between Karl Rove on the one hand on the right and Karen Hughes sort of on the pragmatic part of Bush. And he said now that he's standing from the middle of the seesaw with Karen on one side, Karl on the other, trying to keep it in balance. One of them just jumped off. And he speaks of Karen Hughes. She's a beauty to Carl's beast. And he quotes, he calls Carl and he says, are you now going to be the power? And Carl says, well, I certainly hope not. I certainly hope not, he repeated, and then howled with laughter.
What's going on there, Helen Thomas?
Well, it does seem that, you know, when one bows out, the other one obviously will get more power. Proximity to the president is everything. I'm sure Karen Hughes thinks that she can be a big help from Austin, Texas, or Dallas, or wherever she's going. But no, there's no comparison.
And does it lead to a different political balance within the White House?
Well, I mean, it's sad to say that. I mean, we're supposed to say the buck stops here, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's supposed to have a real mix of advice, I suppose that Karl Rove will be more powerful in that sense, but I think that the president listens only to the right, myself. I think he's very, very conservative.
Is Ari Fleischer giving a straight picture, then, of what's going on in that Oval Office?
What is that picture? He's always been on a short leash. I mean, he says what he's told to say. He's on one page no matter what you ask.
So the picture is a narrowly painted one.
Pretty much so, I would say. You know, I mean, I think he's very well-meant. He's good-natured. He stays within the realm. But great press secretaries, you know, have a little more leeway, and they wear two hats, and they understand that the nature, the real skits nature of being press secretary is to not only be a spokesman for the president and for the United States and for the American people, but you owe something back to the American people, and that is to tell reporters what's going on so they can be an informed public.
We've just got a minute left, Helen Thomas, but what's a moment that you carry away from the White House that keeps you laughing even when things are grim?
Even when things are grim. Well, I think basically the Kennedy era, when they had young kids running around and revealing things going on in the upstairs and so forth, hallowed halls, the children's laughter, Caroline John F. Kennedy Jr. and so forth. Those are fond memories, I think. Everything's gotten very gruesome and grim, I mean. Not gruesome, but grim.
Well, we'll read your book and keep laughing through the history and hope for more humor there. Helen Thomas, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Helen Thomas is author of the new book, Thanks for the Memories, Mr. President. You can read an excerpt from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
In a moment, a Rhode Island man journeys to the Australian outback to return a sacred stone to its rightful owners. This is On Point. In 1962, John Harkey's father was working in the oil industry in Central Australia. He was a souvenir hunter and an amateur anthropologist, and when he returned home, he brought with him a small stone that turned out to have an incredible history. In this diary, John Harkey tells the story of this remarkable souvenir and about the journey he took to fulfill his father's wish to return the ancient object to its Aboriginal owners.
My father passed through the small town of Hermansburg, where a Lutheran mission had been started before the turn of the century and had since gone out of business, as it were, handing the community back over to the Aborigines. The old buildings were open to visitors, and once inside, my father came across a small object, an Aboriginal artifact that was for sale. He asked about it and purchased it and brought it home. A number of years later, he discovered what it is that he brought home. It's called a Turinga stone. At some point, my father decided that the stone needed to go back to Australia. He became aware not only of its past importance to the Aboriginal religion, but believed that it had a potential for becoming important once again. I heard him say often, "The stone really should go home." I think that he wanted it to go to a museum. He felt that it was not only an important Aboriginal object, but deserved to be kept safely in a museum. Not an unusual attitude. My self-assignment was to take the stone not just back to Australia, but to return it, if possible, to the hands of the Aborigines who had originally forfeited it. That was no small task. This process was complicated by the fact that most Aboriginal men don't like to talk about Turinga stones. It's such a sensitive subject. Its qualities resonate with some of our own sanctified objects. The Catholic Church venerates saints' relics. A piece of a finger bone from St. Jerome might be an equivalent to a Turinga stone. In another way of looking at it, a Turinga stone might be considered an equivalent of the stone tablets of Moses. What you begin to see is that the Turinga stone is believed to be an object that came from a period of origins, the very beginnings of Aboriginal personhood, which is called the Dreamtime. The Dreamtime is a familiar term for what the Aborigines call Jacorpa, which means that which is real. The Dreamtime is a period of origins. It's a creation period. And Turinga stones were believed to have been created during that time by the totem ancestors, the original kangaroo men, the original wallaby men, the original emu men, and so forth. The Turinga stone is considered not only to be a token from that period, but to embody the very spirit of the totem ancestors. So you can see the Turinga stone is held in tremendous respect. Its mishandling by anyone in the traditional Aboriginal culture could likely suffer from retribution as grave as death. It's a stone that is venerated, it's feared, and is still considered to hold tremendous power. The Turinga stone, for me, as I was growing up, was a mute object. It was a curious piece of stone with some carvings on the surface that I couldn't understand and had little interest in. In fact, most Turinga stones would incite about the same amount of curiosity in any viewer. They're a very humble object. After my father died, I refamiliarized myself with parts of his life. And one of the things I did was to open his cabinet of artifacts that he'd collected throughout his career working around the world. There are some wonderful things there. But the Turinga stone was singular, and I learned a little bit more about it when I uncovered in his library a tape-recorded conversation that he'd had with an American archaeologist. And in their dialogue, I learned for the first time what the significance of the Turinga stone is. At that point, I thought that this would be a tremendous adventure to take it upon myself to go back to the country where I had grown up, and to return the stone to a part of that culture, that world that I had known nothing about as a child. Still in the center of Australia, just outside of Alice Springs, Aborigines are living in virtual traditional ways, albeit in settlements, no longer living a life of hunter-gatherers, which they had been pursuing for upwards of 60,000 years. Of course, going home to Adelaide, where I was a boy, was tremendous fun. My friends were still there. The school was still there. The center of Australia, I had never been to. I took a train from Adelaide to Alice Springs. It was an overnight train, and when dawn came the next morning, I was in a different world. This was no longer the green belt that surrounds the country's perimeter. This was a very stark desert landscape. When I stepped off the train in Alice Springs, I was carrying the Turinga stone in a cigar box. And my anthropologist associate and I loaded into his Land Rover and set off out of Alice Springs cross-country. The pavement ran out. It turned into a desert track between sand dunes. And within half a day, we had come within sight of the village of Papunya. Papunya is a site with tremendous religious significance for the Aborigines who once called it home. Papunya is now a settlement where Aborigines from the central and western deserts have been brought. It's not a pretty sight. Papunya has an atmosphere that would be familiar to anyone who has visited some of American Indian reservations that are having hard times. Many of the problems are the same. The stone was identified. It was assigned a dreaming story and a place of origin. This place of origin was within a day's walk of the Lutheran mission where my father had bought the stone in the first place. The ceremony was simple. There wasn't a lot of fanfare. The men acknowledged the effort that I had made to bring the stone, saying, "That's a long way to come." The men looked at the stone and passed it from hand to hand, and the conversation was very lively, even though I couldn't understand what they were saying. They were obviously intent on determining just what the engraved designs were originally meant to say. Even though their symbols, the circles, the lines, and the dots are so simple, they tell a very profound story. Yet the men who are able to read these stones, to ascribe them to a history, and keep that history alive, are old and dying. It was a tremendously fortunate stroke of luck that we were able to connect with these men, that they had the heritage to read the stone, and the authority to welcome it back into their culture.
John Harkey lives in Providence, Rhode Island. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Samantha Sodikson and Jim Moses. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded.